I really should have been serving a term in Borstal for the first challenge. If truth be known, Jeff,
the one that he feared the most was Stuart Pearce.
A good, clean tackle, whether it's aggressive or whether it's not, is always revered. It's an art in the game. My mentality was always never show the opposition you're hurt. I can rough up a winger, but I tell you what, this is a different game altogether running at some of these boys. So we hashed up the idea that I would play under an assumed name as a Russian goalkeeper called Yak Jensen. We had some juicy tackles between myself and Rudin. To be fair to him, he never moaned once.
Hello, our guest today on the Jeff Stelling Show with OLBG is a man for nearly a quarter of a century who struck fear into the heart of opposing wingers from Willesden to Wembley, from the City Ground to the Berlin Ground. And as a lover of the Stranglers, the Sex Pistols and the Clash, he probably still strikes fear into the heart of those whose playlists include the likes of Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles and Elton John, like mine. I am with that legend who is Stuart Pearce. Hi, Stuart, how are you doing?
Brilliant, Jeff. Really good to be here.
Good. It's great to have you here as well. I have to ask you straight away, how long do you think you would last on the pitch in this day and age?
I always pride myself on being very cold and very calculating on a football pitch. So, I mean, I've got a reputation of being a tough tackler and whatever, but in 1,000 matches in my career with non-league and everything, I've been sent off 5 times. You know, once it was for swearing at the referee because someone kicked Roy Keane, and one was being the last man in a challenge. So my reputation really doesn't tell you the whole story. I always went up to a certain level and then tried not to get sent off, but Brian Clough sort of drummed that into me, don't let the team down mentality.
Was that anything to do with the Leicester red card?
The Leicester was actually 2 yellows. That was my first ever sending off at Leicester away in the League Cup. And the first challenge, I really should have been serving a term in Borstal for the first challenge, if truth be known, Jeff. And then he said to me at half-time, keep out of trouble. And so I said, all right, fine. I mistimed a challenge on 47 minutes that was worse than the first one. And the first one was bad, I must say. Got sent off. He wouldn't speak to me for a week. Literally, wouldn't speak with me for a week. And you learn quickly, you know, that mentality of if you let us down now, you'll let us down when it really matters. And, you know, as I say, from that moment on, I got sent off 4 more times previously for minor-ish events.
Yeah. You were an angel compared to some, weren't you? I mean, Roy Keane, what, 13 red cards?
Yeah.
Vinny, 12. Mark Dennis, remember him?
Yes.
Mark Dennis, well 12 and truly. Red cards.
Yeah, but and to be fair, I used to talk to the referees as well, so I was pretty polite to the referees, and I almost got some tolerance from the referees as well.
You got them on your side.
I did. I got them on my side. I remember David Ellery, who was a disciplinarian school teacher at Harrow, had a real reputation of being a strict referee. And I was booked already. We were playing Blackburn at the City Ground, and on about 80 minutes, I failed someone, and I should have gone. And he called me over, and I was expecting to be sent off. And he just looked at his watch and went, we've got 10 minutes. Do you think he can keep out of trouble? I said, yeah, of course. I said, thank you very much. As I walked off the pitch, I went up to him and said, thank you very much. You didn't have to do that, but I do appreciate it. And it's just that connection. I think that's lost a little bit, Jeff, with players and referees nowadays.
Yeah, Matt Letizia will still say that of all the players he played against, the one that he feared the most was Stuart Pearce.
It was a backhanded compliment. I always said I would never waste a booking on somebody that I didn't have to. But certain individuals, you thought, hang on a minute, I've probably got one decent challenge here, so I've got to make it right. And, you know, the likes of Pat Nevin and Tiz, they were outstanding players that caused you a big problem. So, listen, it's a compliment in its own way that I give them some special treatment.
Were you aware, you know, on occasions that somebody, a winger that you'd be playing up against, was fearful of you?
Yeah, I think you know that. I would often, if I'm challenging for a header, if you like, quite often shout extremely loudly, you know, always use my surname if I was going to jump for something and just scream Pearce, coming through or something of that nature, because quite often it's human nature to sort of shrink a little bit if you've got your back to somebody that you think might challenge aggressively. So it was a means to an end. I've got to say, I didn't play up to it off the pitch in any way, shape or form, but on the pitch, if it served a purpose to make my life and the team's life easier, so be it.
This might sound a daft question. Was there anybody on the pitch in your playing career that you were wary of, that you were a bit fearful of?
Yeah, there's quite a few. You knew if you were going in for a challenge with Vinnie Jones that there was going to be a full-blooded challenge coming both our ways. Mick Harford, you knew. Billy Whitehurst, I played against, you know. There was a few dangerous characters. Ian Bowyer at Forest would stand his ground. There was a lot of players. I come from non-league. I had 250 games in non-league before I started my journey, and I didn't have any reputation at all about being a tough tackling player. In fact, I got roughed up by wingers that had been around the game a long time and whatever. So you had to look after yourself, and then you arrive in the pro game and people all of a sudden think you're quite aggressive. And I'll point to where I've come from and think, well, you've seen nothing from where I've come from. You had to protect yourself.
Do you think, I know a lot of attacking players will say the game is better because of the fact that you don't see the thunderous, full-blooded challenges that you used to be. Do you think the game suffers at all because of the comparative lack of physicality?
In some ways, yeah. You can go to any ground in the country, and if someone puts a good challenge in, everyone enjoys that. You can tell the environment and whatever. A good, clean tackle, whether it's aggressive or whether it's not, is always revered. It's an art in the game, you know. It's an art to make a challenge and not foul somebody. You know, I never tried to foul anybody. I always try to win the ball in the main. So, you know, it should be revered. Now, it's gone out the game a little bit. It's protecting the strikers. But listen, I think it might have gone slightly too far, because I see good challenges get punished sometimes with red and yellow cards, where I think, I deem that even in today's standards a good challenge.
Well, what do you, as someone who played part of a game with a broken leg, what do you feel when you see the way players react to some challenges these days, the sort of theatricality of it? Yeah. And even in some cases, and I'm thinking of an incident, you know, recently when Calafiori screamed in agony in the West Ham Arsenal game, and within seconds he was on his feet. There's nothing wrong with him. How do you view things like that?
Some of that saddens me. The other side of it, I just feel, from a refereeing point of view, we've got to get stronger. We've got to empower the referees to say, look, this is unacceptable. Nobody sat on the terraces or stood on the terraces enjoys that. Even if it's your own team, you get frustrated by it. And we've got to get a little bit cuter at the refereeing level, I think, in exposing what is a free kick and what isn't. Because at the moment, it's near enough, whoever falls on the floor gets the free kick. For safety, it's as though, well, I can't get it wrong if I give everything of that nature. And that's the way the game's gone a little bit. And I think it frustrates the British public to an extent. But listen, it is what it is. Until we empower the referees and support the referees a little bit more, they'll continually make decisions that are probably politically correct, if you like.
I mean, it used to be seen as sort of a sign of weakness if you stayed down.
Yeah, my father wouldn't accept me staying down. My mentality was always never show the opposition you're hurt. He would not, at the end of extra time in any games, never roll your socks down. You're sending a message to the opposition that you're tired, so you wouldn't do that. If I had a good shot on target and the goalkeeper made a save that was probably the best save I've ever seen in world football, I would never congratulate him. I'd never pick a player up unless it was going to save me a booking. So I don't see why you would, you know. All you're doing is building confidence of the opposition or whatever. So probably just a different generation I was brought up in, and the guidance my father and eldest brother give me to playing football.
I mean, obviously, we'll touch on Brian Clough later on, but we were chatting before, and you were just saying there, you know, when Forrest have gone to Millwall, well, Clough, he had a unique way of showing no sign of weakness.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, Millwall, it was the old First Division in those days. They just got promoted, and there was talk about sort of crowd trouble at Millwall at the old den and that type of thing. We played them away from home, one of the early fixtures of the season. We had pre-match at the hotel, got on the bus, drove to the ground. All of a sudden, the bus has pulled over. We're not at the ground yet. And Cluffy stood up saying, come on, get off. So he gets off. We all get off, all the players. And we walk the last mile to the old den, you know. And he's at the front of it with his walking stick and green top on, and we're all behind him following him to the ground. And it's like, well, look, you don't scare us, we're in town today and we're coming to play you at a game of football. So that was his unique style.
Yeah, I mean, I know you're a lover of rugby league and you go and watch Warrington Wolves. I mean, do you ever think when you're watching them, why can't footballers be like this lot?
I think they did used to be. It's just that the culture has changed a lot now, you know. I was there on Sunday. My team got beat by Hull KR, and in all honesty, it's fantastic for me turning up. I want my team to win, but I want to see a great game of rugby and I want to see the best team win. We got beaten on the day, but there's no theatrics between the players in the main. You know, people pray together at the end of the game. All players from both teams always go around the perimeter or go to their own fans. They have a picture with the young children there. It's just so refreshing, Jeff. And I love it, from going to a game of football on the Saturday to a game of rugby where the culture is so different, especially rugby league.
Yeah. You ever thought that maybe you'd have preferred to play rugby league?
I can rough up a winger, but I tell you what, this is a different game altogether running at some of these boys. They are... They're a special breed. I've got so much respect for rugby league players.
I've seen that sort of camaraderie in Gaelic football as well, you know, where the fans from each side, they sit together, the players mix with it, and it's brilliant. It's a completely different world. Right, before we crack on, let me tell you about something rather special. The good people at OLBG have put together some incredible prizes for you to win. Head to olbgprizes.com/stelling. That's olbgprizes.com/stelling to take a look. You can win signed shirts from the guests that we've had on the podcast, proper footballing royalty like the man sat opposite me today. You can also win a seat in the studio to watch us record an episode, so proper behind the scenes stuff, if you like. You'll get to meet me, that's the downside. You'll get to meet the guests, that's the upside. So olbgprizes.com/stelling. And we'll have all the details in the description for this episode. So make sure you go and have a little look right now. 18 plus only. T's and C's apply. Free entry route is available. Let's talk about you and your career, Stu, because, first of all, you started off as a part-timer at Wealdstone. Promise me you won't mention Wealdstone 7, Hartlepool 0 this season.
Well, we have breached that already this afternoon, haven't we? So, yeah, one of the bigger results this season for the Stones. Hopefully a trophy win will be bigger.
So, look, we got a picture of you here in your Wealdstone. How old would you be then?
17.
17?
Yeah, I left school. I had nowhere to play football. So I was at QPR for 6 months as a 13-year-old and got released. Had nowhere to go. We had a really good school team, champions of London on 3 occasions over the 6 years. And 5 of us went to Wealdstone to train youth team and reserves the first year. At the end of the first year, I broke into the first team, not on ability, on the fact that the senior pros couldn't take time off work, you know, because we had so many fixtures cancelled. You know what it's like in the National League or the Alliance as it was then. We were playing 3-4 games a week. So the senior players said, I'm not taking any more time off work. So kids like me got thrown in. And fortunately for me, I stayed in the team for the next 4.5 years.
15 quid a week. That's what I read anyway.
£15 a week I was on. Not when I first broke in the team. I had no contract then, but once I got in the team, £15 a week, £3 win bonus, £1.50 draw bonus. So big money. Not big money in those days, but it was the first time someone ever paid me to play football.
Yeah.
So I was really excited by it, I've got to say.
Who were you earning more? Because you were an electrician.
Yes.
Were you earning more? There you go.
Yeah.
Were you earning more from being a Spark than you were from playing football?
I was fortunate enough that Bobby Gould came to see me when I was 21 years old playing for Wealdstone. Someone had mentioned my name in a team meeting on a Monday morning. He come and on the Tuesday and looked at me play at Yeovil. On the Wednesday, he agreed a £25,000 transfer fee at Wealdstone for me to change. On Friday, I went in and said goodbye to... I was working for Brent Council. I just qualified 6 weeks as an electrician and said goodbye to everyone I worked with. Played my last game the next day against Basildon in the FA Cup third qualifying round, which I didn't actually see the significance of that game until... I was cup-tied in January against Manchester City playing for Coventry because I played against Basildon. On the Monday I went up, I was earning £220 as an electrician and £60 at that time as a footballer, £280. And Gordy offered me a wage cut of £30. So I was on £250 playing in the top division, playing against Ian Rush, Dalgleish and the like. So I took a wage cut to end up living away from home and whatever, so... Different times.
Just before we move on to Coventry, while you're at Wealdstone, you were just telling us before we started to record this that you were playing as a goalkeeper in Sunday League as well.
Yeah, I am.
A goalkeeper.
All my mates from sort of northwest London, I used to go down the pub when I got back from Wealdstone games, go down the pub and meet them or whatever. And they're school friends from growing up, primary and secondary school. So there was a big clutch of us in the pub, and we used to play in a team called Dynamo Kingsbury Kiev. Like we build ourselves as a pseudo Russian team when there was a bit of mystique about the Russian Empire in the sort of late '70s, early '80s. They were all having a good fun on a Sunday morning playing. I wanted to play, so we hashed up the idea that I would play under an assumed name as a Russian goalkeeper called Yak Yensen. So I used to play as Yak. Used to wear an orange and black kit, black shorts down to my knees with CCCP across both kneecaps. And I was rush goalie, basically, on the West Fulham and District. I played about 2.5 years. Once, I think it was the 81-82 season, I was top scorer with 8. Our centre forward was a little bit pissed off because he only got 7 that year. He denies that's the case, but I remember it. But I used to go up for all corners, all free kicks, no matter what time of the game it was. I used to take every free kick and, listen, it was just good fun on a Sunday morning being with your mates.
I love the fact, Stu, that you still go back to Wealdstone and you still fly the Wealdstone flag and things. Brilliant.
Yeah, I'm fortunate. I do a bit of sort of ambassador work for the non-league setup with a company called Pitching In, and they're really, really good, to be fair. They're putting funds into the non-league system. And I think sometimes when that's been your lifeline to get started in football like I have, it's wrong to sort of turn your back on that and forget where you've come from. You know, you hear stories about people who forget that where they've come from. But I always think that I've always had a sort of very even keel on where I've come from. And I really enjoy going back to Wealdstone when I can. And obviously I work it around my sort of media commitments and all that game, but it's nice to go back and see the next generation of youngsters as well.
Do you think the fact that you did come from a background like that, you're playing as a part-timer at Wealdstone, you know, earning the bulk of your money elsewhere as well, do you think that's helped you throughout your life?
100%, Jeff, without a doubt. To be honest with you, it's grounded me from the offset. I've still got the same group of friends that I had when I was at primary school as a 9-10 year old, so I've kept that. You know, I lead a normal life, and that's where I see myself fortunate that I've not been a player in this era in many ways. I think they lose a little bit of reality check about where they are. They're courted in academies and that type of thing. I've not had that. You know, I've had to work for a living. I was working prior to being an electrician. I worked in a radio and TV warehouse lifting boxes for a year before I got my electrical apprenticeship. So I'm fortunate. It's grounded me brilliantly, and that's stuck with me wherever I've gone and whatever I've done.
Which is absolutely brilliant. When you got to Coventry then, how did the other players, the established sort of first teamers, treat you? Here you are. You know, you've come from non-league football. You've been a part-timer.
Yeah.
Did they welcome you in straight away?
Well, I think a few of them, there was a real different vibe in the dressing room in regard. I mean, I turned up, bear in mind, Trevor Peake used to play for Nuneaton, so and went to Lincoln, then come on to us, who become a good friend of mine. And certain players come with different journeys, you know, Bob Latchford and Kenny Hibbett, two players, iconic players from the late 60s and 70s, you know, were in the dressing room. Sam Allardyce was in the dressing room as well at the time. So a real mixed bag of players. But we also had a clutch of players, Graham Withy, come from Bath City. So we had a real clutch of players that come from differing journeys to arrive there. So we had some players come from the non-league setup as well. I think Gordy was chipping back on the money and whatever. And to be honest with you, it was pretty good. I was lucky that I played one game for the reserve team away at Blackpool. And after that game, John Sillett was the manager of the reserves. After that game, he told somebody a friend of a friend, after that one game, he said he'll play for England, which is unbelievable when you think about it. One reserve game from a non-league player. Within 2 weeks, I was in the first team at Coventry, playing against QPR, the team I supported and got released from. Terry Venables was the manager. Played well that day and stayed in the team, really, and that was the journey I went on.
I mean, you've played under some great managers as well, haven't you, over the years? I mean, obviously, we mentioned Bobby Gould there. You mentioned Terry Venables as well. You played for England under Terry, Dalglish and Keegan and Bobby Robson.
Yeah.
And, of course, Cluffy.
Yeah.
I know Cluffy was different to the rest of them.
Yes.
Was he the best?
I would have to say yes, because I worked for him from the age of 23 till 31. So really informative years. I think he, as a manager, kept you really grounded. He added to probably my upbringing as well about being really grounded and respectful, and team ethic was massive for him, you know. So he's a massive influence on me, no doubt. 7 of the 8 years I worked for him, I was his captain as well. So for Brian Clough, to want you to join him as well as Nottingham Forest was incredible. And for him to see something in me that said, would you captain this team?
I mean, was he as, of course, I look back at the days when he was the ex-Hartlepool manager, and Peter Taylor was you know, alongside him in those days as well. Was he as eccentric as people bill him to be?
Yes. I mean, every day was slightly different. Some days are predictable, eccentric. If we went to Wembley and played in a cup final, you knew the following day we'd be in training and he'd run you. If we got beat on a Saturday, he might well turn round and say, I'll see you next Friday. Yeah. So, you never knew what was coming. You know, dropping us off on the coach at Millwall, let's say. We've pulled the coach over on the M1. He's got off with a tray of sandwiches to a lorry driver who's got his head under the bonnet trying to fix his coach, you know, offers him a salmon sandwich and he gets back on the coach and off he goes. And the driver's sat there thinking, was that Brian Clough just offered me a sandwich, you know? Yeah, it just, every day was slightly different, but it was brilliant. I mean, he was incredible. I remember there was a time where the captain and the manager had to go into the referee's room pre-game at 2 o'clock. And we were playing away at Sheffield United, Bramall Lane. And it was Vinnie Jones, Dave Bassett, me and Cluffy with 4 officials in a room that was a fraction of the size of this. And it was like pantomime in there, you know. Vinnie's walked in and said to Cluffy, you're not going to talk your normal are you? And Cluffy said, what did he just say to him? It was absolute ridiculous, you know what I mean? But just brilliant, all the same.
Yeah, I'd have loved to have seen how Cluffy would have got on with Evangelos Marinakis at Forest now.
That would have been interesting. He run it from top to bottom, Forest, no doubt. And to be fair, it's fair to say, done a brilliant job.
Oh, an amazing job. I mean, I'll tell you know, when I was a Cub reporter in the Northeast, I worked for a radio station called Radio Tees. And one day the management had this great idea. And it was an unusual idea at the time that they'd run a radio auction. And I was responsible for getting football memorabilia and such like from all the top division clubs as they were then. So I wrote to every single top flight club. So we were based in Middlesbrough. So got lots of Middlesbrough, we're a top flight club then. Got lots of stuff back from Middlesbrough. Nothing from any other football club in the country. And then one day, the phone in my office went and the newsroom secretary said, Jeff, we've got a Mr. Clough for you. And it was Brian himself. And he literally just said, and I won't try and do the accent, but look, young man, he said, got your letter. What do you want? He said, would you like some signed shirts, some signed balls? And that would be fantastic. And sure enough, they arrived. He was the only person, apart from my local club, who got in touch, you know. It was, I mean, I know he was an enigma in some ways, but all my dealings with him, limited dealings with him, were really positive, you know.
Yeah. So. As I say, you could catch him on a good day or catch him on a bad day. It was that was him, you know what I mean? But his record, when I first walked into Nottingham Forest and looked round the walls and what he'd achieved, you know, 5 years earlier, they'd won the Champions League, the European Cup as it was then. Just incredible how he's shaped that football club. And when I go back now, Jeff, I've got to say, you walk in there and you look round, you think he's responsible for all the history at this football club, whether it be the era of player I had or prior to that when they had real success at the club. It was just incredible.
I mentioned all those managers, by the way, and we've touched on a few of them during the course of it. There was one who I suspect you didn't get on with, and I know you loved him as a player, but you were at Newcastle when Ruud Gullit was there, weren't you?
Yeah, that was an interesting one. Ruud come in, Kenny packed in after the first day of the season. Kenny signed me. So Ruud sat all the experienced players down and I'm going to need you and whatever, which was fine, with the right thing to do as a manager. I look back with my manager's head on. After 12 games, I think I've ended up sort of, I come home one day, we played away at Liverpool, and I said to my then wife, I said, I don't think I'll play again for this club. She said, what makes you say that? I said, I just got a feeling. And I never did, from December right through to the following season when I left. And the players used to say to me, I was bombed with the kids, really, you know. And they basically, Ruud said to me, look, you can play in the reserves or don't play at all, I'll leave it with you. So I said, no, I'd rather play in the reserves and help the kids. So I was 37, the kids nearest one to me is 21. So it was really good. It was a great learning for me. I'd never been not picked in any football team I've ever been involved in from the time I broke into Wealdstone's team, never been dropped. So it really taught me a great deal when I went into management about what it's like not to play every Saturday or be considered to play every Saturday. So, but in training, you know, Ruud used to join in and Shearer and the rest of them were leaving tackles between the three of us because they knew I wanted to get some frustration out. So we had some juicy tackles between myself and Ruud. And to be fair to him, he never moaned once, you know, I remember putting him over my shoulder once, but he just got up and played on. He's tough enough.
I love the way you take the positives out of everything.
You have to. Brilliant. You have to. You really do. I mean, it was a big one for me when I went and joined the youngsters and Tommy Craig was the manager and we used to train and I used to play in the reserves. And we used to talk to these kids and these kids said, oh, Ruud don't even know our name, doesn't even come and watch the reserves, doesn't know our name. And it never struck me because I'd never been in the reserves as a senior player, you know, apart from recovering from injury, then the mentality is different. And then I thought, these kids have got to be loved. They've got to know that there's a pathway and a career for them. Not just the players themselves, but the coaches at the academy have got to know what we're doing here is going to benefit the first team, and the first team manager has got to take a real interest. So when I joined Forest as a manager, well, the first thing I do is go to the academy. How can I help you? What can I do for you? Go and watch. I finish my training session, I'll go and watch the kids play, you know, get to the reserve game. Moisey was brilliant for it. Watched every reserve game that he could get to. He watched every one. So none of the players playing in the reserves could say, you've not watched me. Because he has, you know, and every manager should do that.
But do they? I mean, in the Premier League, what percentage of managers would go and watch the reserves or the kids play?
Well, not many do, and even, this transformed as well. I go into the FA to work as under 21 manager. I go to every tournament or watch every age group below the one I'm working for that I possibly can. I get the opportunity to manage England. I'm managing England, the senior team, when Fabio left. So on Wednesday night, I think it was, or Tuesday night, I don't know which, we're playing Holland at Wembley. I get in my car and go from the Grove and drive round to Orient's ground to watch England under-17s. Walk in the dressing room. They know the England manager tomorrow night is in watching them under-17s level. That's what you should do.
Yeah, what a lift. What a lift for them.
Yeah, exactly. There's no excuse. But I've seen it many times where they don't. But they should. It should be the norm.
So we mentioned the positives you take from things that some people might perceive as a negative. Tell me whether there were any positives from Italia 90 and the penalty against Germany.
Yeah, I'll tell you one. We come off the pitch. I was picked to do a drugs test. Two players from each team were picked to do a drugs test after every game. Bizarrely, Gazza, who'd been picked on random six previous times, wasn't picked. I'm joking there. Me and Schiltz were the two England players. So we walk out, you go into a room, you've got to give a urine sample before you leave the room. We're losing £7 of sweat per game. We walk in there, Schiltz had been fueling and drinking during the game. Being a goalkeeper, he hadn't lost the sweat that I did. He gave a quick urine sample and left. I sat in a room with two German players. The three of us sat in a room. They never said a word for the best part of 2 hours. So, nor did I. We just sat there in total silence. They had just won a World Cup semi-final. 4 days' time, they were about to win the final. I missed a penalty and contributed to England going home at semi-final stage. And that taught me a valuable lesson that day. I didn't realise that day, but when I look back, I thought the humility that they showed in success was incredible. And I took that with me. So when I scored a penalty 6 years later for England and everyone celebrated against Spain, we scored, I scored my penalty, everyone was excited. Dave Seaman made a save and that put us through to the semi-finals. Everyone celebrated with Dave. I didn't. I went straight to the Spanish player and subsequently the other Spanish players that had been beaten that day because of my experience against the Germans. And I think every eventuality, there is a positive to be drawn from it. And I try to take that with me in my life now, that if you look hard enough, you have to get yourself to a crossroads where it's a win-win. I see so many people go to a crossroads in life and they got to make a decision. It's a lose-lose. Now, you've got to be more positive than that.
I mean, you were pleased when you scored the penalty, though, weren't you?
Reasonably pleased that day. It made a nice change to hit the net, but that was some day as well because I'd been around the block. I was 33, 34 years old. I've come full circle, if you like. I mean, I worked in Brent where Wembley is as an electrician. I used to work at the stadium and now I'm on the pitch at the stadium and representing my country. So it was. And I think the fans, that summer of football was incredible in England as well. And the fans in the stadium that day were just incredible, I've got to say. It was an amazing summer.
And everybody remembers. You know what? I think everybody remembers you scoring that penalty against Spain and the subsequent one again against Germany just as much, if not more, than the one in Italia 90 because of the fact that you'd stepped up to take it. You'd shown the bottle. You'd shown the character. Everybody loved that moment.
Yeah, but as I say, all of those moments are all part of your journey. And like in 1990, because we were fairly ill-prepared as a penalty-taking team, that taught me a lesson as well to make sure that the generation of England players that were under my care were better prepared when they stood out for England and took the penalty. So after every training session, when I say every training session, I'm talking about everyone. 2 years away from a major tournament, every player took a penalty. Every player's penalty was recorded on film and that was fed back to the players. That's why I know Joe Hart's save ratio is 17%. He's faced 350 penalties in total, either in game situations or in my care. Same with James Milner. His scoring ratio is 83%, because we've done all the analysis on it that makes sure that it doesn't affect me. I'll never take a penalty again. But those youngsters that come through that system, they should be, when they step out maybe this summer, they should have gone through that process, and I know they did with Gareth.
So what did you do at Italia 90 then? Had you practiced penalties?
Yeah, practiced, but it was ad hoc. No one knew until we got to the penalty situation. And when Bobby says, you know, Gary Lineker's going to take a penalty, and then it's, do you fancy one, do you fancy one, do you fancy one? That's not an exact science. For me, it never was. So when the under-21s ended up getting to a major penalty shootout, I walked on the pitch. I've got a list of stats in my pocket. And then I say, you're taking 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You're taking 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. You're taking 11. And statistically, they're taking in an order that's preferential, because we've done the study of world penalties shootouts. So the most important penalty is the first one. The second most important is the fourth one. So our best was 1. Our second best was 2. Joe Hart took a third penalty because we'd done the practice, and statistically he was in the top 5 penalty takers. So unless you do that, you end up having people walking up to take a penalty, like Gareth, like Ince, like Batty, that are not penalty takers, like Chris Waddle, if you like. You know, I was different. I was a penalty taker. But why would you put players up there that have never taken a penalty before in their life? You know, why would you do that? You have to do the homework.
And we've all seen it happen as well, where, you know, your top scorer, maybe your penalty specialist, he wants to take the fifth one because he wants to score effectively what is the penalty that he thinks is going to seal the game.
But quite often there is no fifth one.
Exactly, exactly.
Yeah, so 1 and 4 are the crucial ones.
Yeah. That's interesting. I tell you what, just hark back to 1990 and compare it with, you know, the current day as well. I mean, at the last Euros, I know within the England squad, and Gareth did brilliantly rebuilding the relationship with the media and the players, but there was still some resentment, I think, amongst some of the squad about some of the media coverage. But I look back to the sort of coverage that the 1990 squad got, and it was horrific. Absolutely horrific. And were the players aware of that, of how much vitriol there was in the media towards them?
Yeah, without a doubt they were. It was a real hostile scenario. Add that to the fact that the media used to travel with the team as well when I first got in the squad. So we used to be sitting on an aeroplane on a tarmac in Eastern Europe waiting for the media to type up their reports an hour later to come and join us on the aeroplane. So there was all that, what we waiting for? We want to go home. We've been away from home. We're prepping for the weekend. All of those things come in the mix. And Gareth, it was a masterstroke by Gareth and the FA. Before 2018 it was, Jeff, at St George's Park, he made all 23 players available in the gym. The media had free access to all the players, and it was a masterstroke, and it broke a lot of barriers down between the media and whatever. And I've got to say, I work on the side of it. I've been fortunate. I've been to World Cups as a player, as a coach. I've done it for TV, I've done it for radio, and I've also, you know, worked, you know, been on the pitch as well, you name it. I've done the whole spectrum. And the support from the media to the team, I think, is really good now, as well as vice versa the other way around.
Yeah, I completely agree with you about, you know, was a masterstroke from Gareth. There's no doubt about that. And talking of that, here he is. We've got a picture of the two of you together. You and Gareth. Your fellow Sex Pistols fan.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure he's a fellow Sex Pistols fan. I mean, we got on famously. From the moment he got in the squad, he had an old head on his shoulders, no doubt about that. I'm a few years older than the gate. But we got on brilliantly in the squad. Both very professional, meant a lot to us. In a culture where the lads used to like going out and having a drink. I never did, and Gareth never did. And we got on really well and always have done. And then we got the scenario where we're in the squad together and we win the penalty shootout against Spain on the Saturday, and we get the Sunday off, and most people can go home. Gazza and Dave Seaman go fishing. You can do what you want. So I get the music papers, the Sounds, NME, Sex Pistols are playing at Finsbury Park, and I'm thinking, brilliant, I need to be there Sunday. So I've had arguably the best weekend of my life here. I've scored for England on Saturday against Spain. I go to Terry Venable Saturday night and said, is it all right if I go to a concert tomorrow, if we got a free day? And he says to me, yeah. I didn't tell him who was on stage. I thought I'd keep that from him just in case. He said, just take a couple of staff members with you. Okay. So I said to Gareth, are you going home? He said, no. I said, oh, I'm going to a gig tomorrow. You fancy it? He said, yeah, all right. So he comes on. I think it's his first gig he's ever been to. And it was a Sex Pistols, Iggy Pop, Skunker Nancy, Stiff Little Fingers on stage. Brilliant lineup in my world. I don't know what the Gape thought of it. We went backstage and met a lot the Pistols before. They've convinced him to wear a Pistols T-shirt as well. So just a brilliant weekend in my world.
Yeah. Did he like it? Did he convert him?
I think he suffered it. I don't think he's ever been to see, he's never been to see the Pistols again. I know that for a fact. So, and I don't think he's been anywhere close to seeing anything that might be punk orientated.
Yeah, and of course, famously, you've seen the Stranglers more than 300 times now. I mean, look, you grew up loving punk, didn't you? That was your bag. And I was just looking at sort of music around the same time, and I'm thinking Queen, ELO, 10cc, Rod Stewart. Were you never tempted? Did you cast them to one side, or did you have a broad spectrum of loves?
You start with an older brother. The nearest brother to me is 10 years older, and his music collection was Bowie, The Who, Alex Harvey, people of that ilk. And sort of I used to listen to some of his stuff, Cockney Rebel, stuff like that. But I got into Bowie. Bowie was my first love, and he was the first love of a lot of people that went into the punk scene as well. Bowie was brilliant. And then all of a sudden, I was sat at home, Jeff, in a lovely living room. Well, not as lovely as this living room, your living room here. I'm watching the Bill Grundy interview, Sunday News, whatever it was called. I don't know what. So I've sat there, 6 o'clock comes on, and then Bill Grundy comes on, and he's got the Sex Pistols with Susie Sue there and whatever in the studio, and they're swearing. And I've never heard, I'm 14 years old, I've never heard anybody on television swear before. And it was brilliant. You know that rebel in you when you're 14 years old. And I'm watching Bill Grundy goading the Sex Pistols. And I'm thinking, this is just brilliant. You know, and they're dropping the F-bomb and whatever and calling him a dirty rotter and God knows what. And it was just brilliant. And to be fair, it was probably slightly before then. But just then, that had massive impact on not just kids like me, but... And the London scene as well was really good. So I used to go to gigs in London and everything. It was right on the doorstep. Really, just brilliant. I loved the music, you know. It had edge to it, excitement. It was just brilliant. It was something new. You could visibly see punk rockers by what they wore and stuff like that. It was just great.
Do you ever get to play your music in the dressing rooms then?
I used to when it first came in the dressing room. I never used to go out and warm up. I used to warm up in the dressing room, a really vigorous warm up, but never went out on the pitch. I had a big influence. I said Kenny Hibbett was in the dressing room at Coventry. We all used to go out. Kenny used to not go out. And I'm looking and then I build up the courage. I say to him, Ken, can I ask you a question, please? He said, yeah. I said, why don't you go and warm up before the game? And he gave me a brilliant answer, Jeff. He looked at his watch and went, I get paid hour and a half, I ain't doing any more. So, you know? And I thought, wow, if it's good enough for him. So by the time I got to Forest and that period, I used to stay in the dressing room. So when the music thing come in, A, I was the captain by that stage, and B, I stayed in for the whole duration. So it made sense for me to bring a compilation tape that was my choice, you know, so which I did. So we used to have sort of... Well, a mixed bag of punk rock, really.
Cliffy ever have anything to say about that?
No, he tolerated it, to be fair. He sat in the dressing room and tolerated it, to be fair to him. So he weren't too bad. It was only sort of me and him in the dressing room because he never, you know, he stayed in there. The coaches were outside. Chairman come in on the odd occasion to say good luck. But it was just me and him, me going through this vigorous warm-up routine and him just killing time.
Yeah. We discuss music on Talk Sport from time to time, obviously.
Yeah.
And my co-host on Mondays and Tuesdays, Ali McCoist.
Yeah, you know? He loves his
He's
music.
An AC/DC man, though, isn't he?
No, so, he likes the punk scene.
Yeah, he done what he does, but if you asked him, you forced him to name his favourite,
okay,
it'd be AC/DC. Would they be on your playlist anywhere?
Not overly. They drop into sort of, you know, the heavy rock scene sort of thing a little bit. I did go and see Iron Maiden a couple of summers ago, which was really good at the London Stadium. And I do go and see varying different bands. I mean, over the next couple of weeks, I've got the 100 Club to see Spear of Destiny, which you won't know. And Friday after that, Take That at Southampton.
Oh, wow.
Carol loves them, so we'll go and watch them. So I do see a mixed bag at the World Cup. We've got penciled in. We've got an all-day festival that the Human League are involved in. Bon Jovi are playing Madison Square Garden 3 days before the final, so that might be one. And Joe Jackson, I don't know if you know him, early 80s.
Yeah,
Jackson.
Different for Girls.
You've got it.
Like
he's playing at a theatre in New York as well. So you've got to be on top of these things. But we've got a clutch of us with TalkSport that quite enjoy the music scene as well.
So look, I've got two tickets for a Taylor Swift concert for you. Would you go?
I haven't heard of her. I don't know. I don't know, Jeff. It's gone over my head. I don't know.
Brilliant.
The answer's no, but I'm sure there's. They would be lost on me. She would be lost on me, to be fair.
Look, let's talk about football again. Who are the players that you really like in the modern game? I know it's a broad question.
If I had to pick one, Bernardo Silva. I think he's magnificent. He runs more than any player in a Manchester City shirt or probably the opposition shirt on a Saturday. Pep never brings him off. He plays him every game when he rotates his team. Bernardo's still playing. And he does everything right that I think a footballer should. So, and what I mean by that is he'll receive the ball and you think, well, he's a diminutive midfield player, so he's just passing. He'll run at someone. It almost looks like Eddie Gray for an older. He'll put the arms out and run at defenders, at fullbacks. And then if people double up on him, he'll put his foot on the ball and roll it to a teammate with the perfect weight and the perfect timing to help one of the team. He just does everything correct, in my opinion, that a modern day footballer should do. I would throw out there as well James Milner and Henderson that I had the privilege of working with at under 21 level, and what a pair of professionals these two boys have turned out to be. They've been incredible. Leadership skills of Henderson especially has been magnificent over the duration and the tough start that he had. Maybe when he arrived at Liverpool they didn't fancy him and he had to come through that adversity to win people over, you know. Yeah, there's certain people that you look at and think, yeah, I tell you what, I like you. I like Mark Gahey, no-nonsense defender, reads the game really well. So there's certain individuals there that something resonates inside you and you think, yeah, I like the way you conduct yourself.
Oh, let's stick with the England squad for a minute or two. Who do you think will fill your role then? Who's going to be left back?
I think at this moment in time, O'Reilly. I think Nico O'Reilly, I think he can supplement midfield. He gets forward really well.
Yeah, an amazing
he can score
season.
You a goal. He's had a brilliant season. He's playing at the top end of one of the top sides in the world.
Where do you see our sort of strengths and weaknesses?
Strengths is at the front end of the team and in wide areas. I think whoever plays in wide areas, and it's very transferable who we've got in those wide areas, Rashford or Gordon or Madueke. It's a real punch out there. And you need, in those wide areas, and I think Tuchel's worked this out, you need wingers as such, type players, to supplement Harry Kane, you know what I mean, and his strengths. So I think he's worked that out. The number 10 role as well, Morgan Rogers has been brilliant. Anderson's on brilliant form at the moment. Declan Rice is on brilliant form. There's two out of three, and you add to that either Bellingham or Rogers or whatever. That's a really impressive three in my world.
Yeah, and they can play together, you think, Rice and Anderson?
100%. If you're playing against the top teams in the world, Declan sits back and plays alongside Anderson. You're playing the best teams in the lesser teams. He squeezes up and initiates the press with Harry Kane from the front with the number 10. I think that's a great trade-off, and I've seen that. Defensively, well, the goalkeeper's got vast experience now. And defensively, you just hope we're good enough. That's the question mark. are we going to be good enough to keep us to a nil in those games that are really tight?
Do you feel we are short in particular of central defenders? I mean, you mentioned Mark Gahey, who's been terrific since he went to Manchester City, but are we struggling for a partner?
I mean, John Stones, once again, for me, he would be the natural one to play alongside him, but he's not had the football as of recent times. Conser's been pretty good as well. So we're also a question mark on Reece James as well, whether he's fit. I think Thomas thinks he's the best right back we have, so we just hope he's fit and available.
Would you agree he's the best right back?
Yeah, in the main, I would say. I think, you know, Livramento's done quite well. Spence is a decent defender, good defender in some ways. But I would say definitely that he's probably the number one at present.
I mean, when you look at the England squad, and you know, look, we got some fantastic talents. And people have got different ways of defining world class or otherwise. But in your opinion, how many world class players will England have in their first choice 11?
I would say Declan can be. Harry Kane, definitely. On his day, Bellingham, yes. On his day, Rashford, potentially. But they've got to be flat out on their day, you know. And depends where your ceiling for world class is. If we're talking about the Messis, Ronaldo's, Pelé's of this world, they're world class that deliver and win tournaments on their own. We're still waiting for somebody to take the team and the performance by the scruff of the neck and get us over the line like Gascoigne nearly did for England back in my era.
You've been there and done it. As an outsider, as a presenter, you know, I look at the England squad and think, oh, we've got a fantastic squad, as I thought at the Euros and as I thought at other championships. Why is it so difficult for us to get over the line?
I think we've probably not focused on penalty shootouts over the years. And I cite my experience, as in lost 2 out of 3 penalty shootouts at semi-final stage. So that might have kept us away from silverware. Players not hitting form at the right time, and I was on the coaching staff when I went to the 2010 World Cup, and a lot of your hopes and dreams are on Wayne Rooney, who had a really rotten World Cup, and we saw it in training. He probably needed leaving out, to be honest with you, but Fabio was forever picking him and putting him in the team in the hope that if England are going to be successful, Wayne's got to hit it off. So if you leave him out, your chances of progressing and whatever, but for the sake of the team, as bizarre as it sounds, he probably needed dropping. I saw it firsthand, you know, and he just lost form totally that summer. You need some of your key players to say clear of fitness as well. You know, make sure that they're fully fit and firing well. So you've got your fingers crossed on some of these boys that they are actually, they hit it off in the summer and things. And also as well, the draw plays a big part in it, you know. Sometimes you think, well, we can beat anyone in front of us, but the timing of when you play these teams, you know, if you're going to take on a big hit, I'll leave them till the final, you know, so.
Do you think we will win it?
I think we'll take some knocking over. If I put my hand on my heart, I'd probably say that the French and Spaniards are probably ahead of us. So we're relying on maybe one or two of those cutting each other's throats and then us playing one of them in the final, then you never know.
Look, if we reflect on your life, Stu, I mean, look, there have been some massive highs, some terrible lows as well, you know, on and off the pitch as well. I mean, the flight back from the States when you've been watching Warrington Wolves, what was the story there? Because you were very ill, weren't you?
Well, I had a resting heart rate of 155, which was quite lively. I don't think I've ever got up to that, even in my playing days. So, just a virus just to take me off. You never know. I always go back to what a friend of mine told me once when I turned 50. And he says, it don't matter anymore. You've gone past the bullseye, so it don't matter. So I always sort of fall back to that, and it makes me laugh. Every time I feel a bit ill or whatever, you think, well, I'm over 50 now. I've had a brilliant life. So, you know, it's that positive outlook almost. But, yeah, that was one. I realised probably subsequently after that, Jeff, I've got to say that it didn't half pay to go through situations of adversity to have good people around you. And it showed me then that I've got a brilliant network of friends around me and footballing friends as well beyond that, which was incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I don't like to raise this, Stuart, but I will nevertheless, and tell me if you don't want to talk about it, because obviously one of those lows was recent as well as the death of your son, you know, very young age.
Yeah, that was very sad for the family. Horrific, really, and worse probably for my ex-wife and his sister. So, but listen, the good thing is, and I don't overly want to talk about it, but the good thing is, after that, went to dinners and whatever, and people come up to me and say to me, look, I lost my son, I lost my dad, I lost this, I lost that, and what you've gone through as well. They've had that connection with me. And I thought to myself at the time, if anything comes good out of this, it's the fact that I can help other people, you know, in losses that they might go through. So once again, you always try and draw that positive from it and say, if people can come up to me and look at me and say, look, this has happened to him. Yeah. It's happened to me recently, so I'm gonna go through it, and there are other people out there, and then I can talk to them about their friends' network, lean on them, pick the phone up, talk to people, all well and good.
Yeah. I mean, I lost my sister at a very early age, and you think you will never ever recover.
Yeah.
Well, you don't. You never forget, but somehow you survive. And maybe your past experiences throughout life have helped you survive. And I just want to show one last picture, because this is after you've been ill. And I just think for a kid who started out as a 17-year-old at Willesden, you know, when you were unwell, to see this at Premier League grounds, get well, Stuart. Yeah. That's amazing.
To be fair, I was sat in a hospital bed in Canada, and I managed to get the game to see that I was supposed to be covering that game, commentating on it for Talksport. And we were watching the game, and all of a sudden, there was this massive applause broke out at 3 minutes. And I'm sat there looking at it, and I turned around to Carol and I said, I think one of the Forest players has died. And it flashed up to the scoreboard, and there was a picture of me on the scoreboard. And I said to her, I said, you better go and get the doctor, get me a second opinion, because at the moment it don't look good at the City Ground, you know what I mean? But listen, that was so, so humbling. I got to say, it was amazing. The family at Nottingham Forest have been brilliant. There were two ex-clubs of mine that happened to be playing on the same day that day. But listen, you realise at times like that for me how much I've affected probably people over my career, and how much maybe I can help them as well going forward if they have bereavements of any description, you know, or any illnesses like I did. It was incredible, very humbling, I've got to say.
Do you miss the day-to-day involvement? I mean, obviously lots of media work and such like.
I'm always at the grounds, so I really love that. I'm at the grounds. I love football matches. I really enjoy it. I love talking football. I enjoy doing a diversity of stuff now. So I travel a lot and do a lot of leadership, motivational speaking with companies, which I really enjoy trying to help them out. Do I miss it? Every now and then, if I go back in and see Moisey and have a day at Everton, I love the environment, you know, but to do it every day is 24/7 football, and my life is sort of diversified a little bit. I love the life I live now, but every time I go back into a footballing environment, you know, just the smell of it is just fantastic.
But never tempted, you know, whether it be Wealdstone or Forest came along and got some role for you?
Well, I've been fortunate. When I've been out of the game, you know, with Kenny Jackett, Kenny had me in at Portsmouth, and I used to just do a bit of coaching there, or I do a little bit of coaching with young kids now with a company called Campioni every now and then. And it gives me a little fix of doing something, which I quite enjoy. But It's all or nothing, really, and for me, time-wise, I enjoy what I do.
Brilliant. Stuart, talking of time, we are out of it. So it's been a joy. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Really enjoyed talking to you, mate. You have been watching The Jeff Stelling Show with OLBG. Join us next time if you can.